This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith, and it's been a busy old week.
Yeah, I've been trying to cycle downhill.
It's very difficult.
Well, this is a bit of a shock to the system. I'd kind of naively thought, because the train journey was mainly up, that this leg of it would be mainly down. But there is a brutal hill. Sun is splitting the sky, it's about 25, 26 degrees. And as you can tell, I'm seriously pecking.
Can I take it your downhill wasn't quite as downhill as you thought it was?
No, you'll hear later on, I was following the Isle Away, which all sense and map reading suggested it was downhill all the way, and it was anything but.
Moan, moan, moan. Talking about hilly terrain, the area around about Loch Ness is spectacular. Beautiful hills. Sometimes it's a bit, or has been in the past, quite difficult to access some of it. The north side of Loch Ness, obviously, I mean, that's a real tourist hotspot.
Yeah, but the south side is pretty much untouched. I mean, there's a couple of wee villages along there, but it's pretty remote.
Yeah, well, joining it up now, making it slightly less remote, is a new trail called Loch Ness 360, which will give a walking, cycling and outdoor activity route round the entire Loch Ness. Graeme Ambrose is the man behind the idea.
Okay, so we're now walking on a new section of the South Loch Ness Trail, the last major section that was completed August last year. The completion of this section, which stretches all the way down to Fort Augustus, has enabled us to link up to the Great Glen Way on the north side and thus create what's now called the Loch Ness 360 Trail.
I don't know whether you're aware of this, but your brother contacted the programme about 3 months ago and said, you need to talk to my brother about this because he's completely obsessed with this.
Is that right? My brother?
Yeah, apparently. But, I mean, you know, it's such an obvious idea because it's fantastic scenery, but it can't have been easy joining all the dots.
No. I mean, lots of people have talked about creating a long-distance route around Loch Ness for years. Essentially, what my organisation and I have been involved with the past 10 years and doing it is really running with the whole project and actually doing it and linking up. This 10-kilometre section down was the real stopper for us. Project started back in 2009-10. The organisation that I used to work for, and we got a bit of funding together, mm-hmm. and we did some of it, but ultimately by 2012, economic climate change, etc, etc, and our organisation was involuntary, so basically the funding kind of ran out. Step on 2 years, new organisation, commitment to do this trail, still got to get the funding. Mm-hmm. So the real change that made it all possible was in 2016, SSE built a section from Fort Augustus up to the Glendale Works. This was a condition of their planning consent, I believe, for Stranraer. Mm-hmm. But suddenly...
That's the wind farm.
The wind farm that you're seeing, yeah. The big wind farm. But suddenly it all became possible for us, and we thought, right, we can do this, we can get the funding. So we applied the improving public access scheme. We've got further contributions from Highland Council, SSE. And last year, bingo, we were up and running. But it's a challenging section. A lot of this ground, well, you can see, still pretty wet, to say the least.
Well, it's notoriously wet round about here.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you just look at the plants, I mean, it's things like bog myrtle and heather and ling and things. Stuff, you know, deer grass, stuff that would indicate poor drainage. On the plus side, the views are spectacular.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we're just beside Loch Tarf here. It's a sort of lovely wee loch with this little couple of islands in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Just across the other side of that ridge, you've got Loch Ness and Fort Augustus.
Yeah. It's a
fantastic if you can get people in here, but where do they stay?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think certainly on the south side. I mean, if you go right back to the start and you look at Loch Ness and what the situation tourism was around Loch Ness, fundamentally, lack of things to do, lack of things to keep people here, low level of spend. And a project like this was essentially about delivering long-term economic benefit, keeping people here longer. Now, yes, absolutely, there is a lack of accommodation. Some would say that's an attraction for it. And the driver for it is not to necessarily bring hordes of people around here. It's about getting people out of their cars. It's the whole health agenda, getting them to stay longer. So things are changing, and we've already seen over the past number of years, particularly down in Foyers, some really new businesses starting up that are based around the trail. And to give you an idea of that, and particularly in some of the international markets we work in, when word got out about this last April into the German markets, in the space of 1 week, we had 100 articles in the German press and media mentioning this new trail.
And that's extraordinary.
It's extraordinary, yeah. It was 100 across.
I bet you didn't get 100 in this country.
No. But, I mean, we had a four-year marketing campaign with Visit Britain, and, of course, their stretch and reach into international markets. So we were astounded.
We're standing on the path at the moment, and it's about 2 metres wide. It's a good surface. It'll compact even further down. The whole route is, what, about 80 miles?
Yes.
I was talking to Ewan about this just the other day, and I said, you know, we should try and do this on bikes or something like that.
Yeah.
It'd be a really good way of doing it. But, you know, we could see where you could stop the other side of Loch Ness.
Yeah.
It's this one. What do you actually do this side? But, you know, if you have to take a tent, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly of the obvious stopping points are Whitebridge and Foyer certainly has a large amount. But it's a case of, well, if you don't do it, then nothing's going to change. We're hoping to do a major, you know, outdoor event on it next year, round running and cycling. So quite excited about that. I mean, the south side has everything. The north side's had the Great Glen Way, and I think it's fair to say there's more varied landscape on this side. So we're confident that give it time, it'll develop and for everybody to enjoy.
What fascinates me about this is, to a certain extent, it mimics the success of tourism in lots of other areas. Right now, demand is actually outstripping, in a lot of places in Scotland, our ability to actually cope with this.
Yeah.
But businesses are coming up behind it. You know, it's creating entrepreneurial opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what, you know, as I say, the driver for all this. You know, I live on the south side as well, and I'm very conscious of what the impact large numbers of visitors can do, and why we want them to come here. We've got to beware, and we all know the info.
There you go.
I haven't seen that for a while.
That was an RAF typhoon, literally just above us. For many, many years, I used to think they'd some means of locating recording equipment, because wherever we stood in Scotland, they would find us. It's been a while since I've seen that, lad.
Yeah, it's a while since I've seen it as well. I've lost what I was saying.
We were talking about entrepreneurial opportunities. It does have a habit of sort of wiping your head, that kind of noise.
Yes, yeah. No, I think that's what it's about. And we're confident that it's coming. It'll bring the type of lower impact. You know, nobody wants to see the product that we have here ruined, if you like, and or some of the problems that you see elsewhere.
Graham Ambrose of Loch Ness 360. And we also have to extend sincere thanks to the Royal Air Force, who shot over, completely scrambling our brains.
A guest appearance. I haven't done any of it yet, but I saw the path the other day when I was sailing down Loch Ness. And it looks like a proper path off the roads as well, rather than just following the road.
Yeah, yeah.
It looks great. We should
I'd
do
quite
it.
Like to do it.
Yeah, we should do it, definitely.
Maybe, I don't know if we've got time to do it this year, but maybe in the beginning of next year, if the weather, if there's a decent weather window, it'd be quite fun to do.
We electric bike.
You're determined to take an electric bike.
I tell you, you know, coming out, if you know Scotland at all, the path comes from the lock level at Fort Augustus and goes straight up.
It goes slightly uphill.
It goes straight up.
Where was it? We did the St Cuthbert Trail. Yep. Wait, which town was it? It was one of the borders towns we came out of, and it was like a 4 mile climb out to this
Moffat.
Oh, don't know. Don't think so. Don't know.
We got it stupidly wrong.
Melrose it was.
We ended up, because there's a lovely two hills outside Melrose, and we ended up carrying these bikes up. And these were second-hand bikes. These were cast iron bikes, not lightweight aluminium.
Oh, no. I've still got mine. Actually, I've still got yours as well. Let's not worry about details. We're always keen to find out more about species that used to roam the country, but they've now become extinct. Now, we've obviously spoken a lot on these podcasts about lynx and beaver, but there are quite a range of animals that no longer exist in Scotland's countryside.
Yeah, ecologist Dr. David Hetherington, who's our regular contributor to this programme, he's been taking a look at some of the animals that we once had, and some might surprise you. I caught up with him in the woods near Granton.
Well, over the millennia and centuries, I suppose, we've lost a real suite of particularly large mammals, and I suppose we know more about them simply because their bones tend to be pretty big and are more likely to be discovered than some of our birds. So, you know, we've lost, well, three species of large carnivore, the lynx, the wolf and the bear. We've lost a suite of large herbivores, wild boar, elk, reindeer, aurochs, which is the wild ancestor of the domestic cattle, and a whole number of birds, including the crane, and quite possibly things like eagle owl as well.
You've been looking at four of them in a little bit more detail. The bear leapt out at me. A lot of people would be surprised we had bear in Scotland. Brown bears or grizzly bears?
Well, there were brown bears, European brown bears. The grizzly bear is actually a subspecies of brown bear. So technically, European brown bears are the same thing as the big bears you'd get in Alaska and Canada, but they are usually typically quite a bit smaller in Europe. But yeah, we did have them in this country. Again, a species that perhaps most Scots would associate more with things like, you know, places like Alaska and Canada. But we know we had them in the past. We know that because their bones have been found at a few places, you know, from the northwest, you know, around the bone caves near Inchinadamph, right down to Dumfries. And we've got radiocarbon dates showing that there were still bears living here 2,700 years ago, which is a long time ago. But of course, we often make the mistake of assuming that the last most recent carbon date is when the animals died out, which of course is extremely unlikely to have happened like that. And we do have cultural evidence that shows that they survived here for much more recently than that. So for example, the Roman writer Martial, he's describing the opening ceremony of the Colosseum in Rome in AD 80, and he talks about some poor unfortunate criminal is dispatched using a very hungry and ferocious Caledonian bear. And Caledonian bears were valued by the Romans because of their large size and because of their ferocity. And that, of course, was for great family entertainment for 50,000 people, a baying crowd. So our sensitivities have clearly changed over the centuries.
So would that be part of the demise, the fact that the Romans were collecting them?
I don't think that would have been a major driver for their extinction. It certainly wouldn't have helped, but I think there would have probably been plenty of bears in Scotland at that time, and I think the trade probably wouldn't have made a massive impact on them. I think a much greater impact would have been the way that we used the landscape. We humans, we would have clearly been felling forests for timber and to clear land for agriculture, and we would have been grazing fairly high numbers of livestock in the uplands for millennia. And, you know, that gradual nibbling away of the vegetation would have prevented woodlands from regenerating, and things, you know, gradually the woodlands would have died off. So, you know, bears we know survive for longer than the Roman era, actually. We've got bears depicted on Pictish standing stones from, you know, the 7th and 8th, 9th centuries from Shetland in the north, although, you know, there wouldn't have been bears in Shetland, but clearly the Picts were more widespread across mainland Scotland too. We've got bears depicted on stones from Easter Ross, from Perthshire, from Angus. So we know they were around until early medieval times, but, you know, as an ecologist looking around Europe, you'd have to say, well, why would they have died out 1,000 years ago, say, when they were still living, until pretty recently, in similarly thinly populated mountainous landscapes in other parts of Europe, including right up until the present day in places like the Pyrenees and parts of the Alps. So that kind of makes me think, well, I don't think they would have died out thousands of years ago or even 1,000 years ago. I think they probably died out here earlier than in some other parts simply because we deforested early and more severely than other places. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if we still had bears up until the 15th, perhaps even the 16th century.
What about elk? You touched on that. What is an elk?
Well, an elk is a horse-sized deer. It's a pretty enormous deer. I suppose to most people, it's probably better known as the moose. Now, the moose is actually, that's a Native American word, and it's used in North America to describe pretty much the same species. So, you know, the thing that we kind of stereotypically might think of as having its head on a wall of a hotel or something like that. Famously, you know, Basil Fawlty was trying to put one up. So, yeah, most people might know it as the moose, but actually the kind of British English word for it is the elk, and that's a word that's very, I suppose, commonly used across Europe. You know, it's elje in Swedish, it's elch in German, and it's elan in French. Now, interestingly, we have a word in Gaelic which is very similar to that word in French, and it's lon, L-O-N. And we do actually have cultural references in the Gaelic language to elk in Scotland. So whilst the radiocarbon dates would suggest the animal might have died out 4,000 years ago, an awful long time ago, the Gaelic cultural evidence suggests that they were still here in medieval times. You know, there are poems and ballads that talk about the calls of deer and elk in Glenshee. There's the Lay of the Black Hound in medieval ballad talks about the hunters hearing the roaring of stags and elk, and at the conclusion of their hunt, they're eating birds, deer and elk. So clearly that's an animal that was still around much more recently than 4,000 years ago.
So did it go the same way because of deforestation?
Yeah, I'm sure it would have done. That's a species that requires large wooded landscapes. It's browsing on particularly broadleaf trees, things like willows and aspens and birches. And those trees, including, of course, our pine woods, they all diminished greatly over the centuries. And it would have certainly fallen victim to deforestation. But also, of course, it was clearly being hunted. There's an awful lot of meat on an elk, and people would have been hunting them. And that, if that was done in an unsustainable way in a context of diminishing woodland, you can see how they went extinct.
Ecologist Dr. David Hetherington. We'll hear more from him later in this podcast. We had a bit of an argument on the live programme about this, between the difference between moose and elk and deer.
Yeah, it's a bit confusing because...
Well, here's the way you explain it.
The elk is the main species. The American moose is a subspecies of the elk. So essentially an elk and a moose are the same thing. But in America there's a thing called an elk, which is actually a deer.
Good. Well, we're glad we sorted all
that. Put
that
one to bed. But fascinating stuff about the brown bears, the fact they were taken to the Colosseum in Rome.
Yeah.
Because Scottish bears are ferocious. Or maybe just hungry.
Well, that's a possibility too. There's a lot of public attention at the moment on the amount of plastic pollution there is about. For some reason, that becomes really, really visible when you're walking along a beach or along a coastline. It just seems to jump out at you.
Well, it's just the way the tide gathers it, and suddenly, you know, it's not just an odd bottle. Yeah. It is a carpet of plastic.
Yeah. And it could be things like fishing nets, ropes, all sorts of things. There's an initiative called Turning the Plastic Tide, which is focusing its attention on the coastline of northeast Scotland. They've teamed up with Stonehaven Sea Safari so that they can access beaches that are in more remote areas. I joined in on a trial run. I'm on a fast rib just heading north out of Stonehaven through big drifts of herring gulls and immature herring gulls and those gannets, and I even saw a skua back there. This is a fantastic stretch of coastline, but because it is so cliffy, much of it is inaccessible. Well, it's inaccessible to humans, but sadly it's not inaccessible to plastics, and that's causing a problem. And there's a new coastal clean-up partnership evolving in an attempt to clean up areas that, frankly, most people just can't reach.
My name's Andrew Buchanan. I run Stonehaven Sea Safari. Our involvement today is quite a remote beach that we're at, very difficult to access from the land, so we're using our sea safari boat to transport people across into the bay, then using a small boat to take them ashore so we can carry on with the beach cleaning.
Why do you want to take part in something like this?
Partly it's important for our business because we do wildlife tours and it affects the wildlife if we've got pollution, but also just on a moral part. I think I'm at the sea every weekend and quite often during the week, and you start to see rubbish floating about, and it's so easy to stop it. It's so easy if people just looked after what they were doing with the rubbish. And the impact that you've got on seals, everybody likes the dolphins, the impact it has on that is quite dramatic. So I think it's important that we start to clean our act up.
Very good.
You're fine.
Okay. Right. Cheers, Andy. Hi, good morning.
I'm Crawford. Nice to meet you, Mark.
Nice to meet you, Crawford.
Hi.
How are you?
Yeah, not bad, yeah. Thanks for making it along.
Oh, this is fantastic. This is lovely.
Yeah.
You've got folk beach cleaning already.
Yeah, we thought we'd get out a wee head start, so we've got some people up here in the dunes, and then we've got a couple just behind the rocks there, so... Yeah,
let me do a full introduction. It's Crawford Paris, Turning the Plastic Tide.
Yes.
Okay, so we're on a beach which is below Stonehaven Golf Club.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult to access any other way other than by boat. You've got Andy's big rub out there. He's got his little brother, which is taking me on shore.
Yep.
There was a lovely... I mean, I just turned round there, because it's a beautiful day. You know, just the waves lapping gently on the shore. The three brightly coloured folk from RNLI standing waist deep in the water. It's an operation to tidy up this kind of stuff.
It is, yeah. It is an operation. It's taken a lot of planning to get to where we are just now, and there's a few elements that needed to come together. It's an operation in itself, yeah.
So my name's Ian Hay, I'm the project manager with the East Grampian Coastal Partnership. And one of the reasons for these remote beach cleans, me and my son were down at Muckles Beach, which is absolutely fantastic. It's half a mile from the A90, but you wouldn't believe you was anywhere, you know, near Aberdeen, near anybody. And it was a stunning beach, but there was one area, probably the size of a living room, where there must have been about 4 tonnes of waste.
Oh, for the love of goodness.
So that's a picture of it the day. Uh-huh. Now... this was August last year, and the stuff had all gathered up into this big pile. So, earlier on in the year, this year, I decided to go and show it to Crawford as somewhere to tackle. So we went down to the beach, and it wasn't clean, but there was probably 10% of the rubbish that had been there the first time.
It comes and goes, that's part of the problem.
Yeah, I mean, nobody had done a beach clean. That rubbish had gone from being in a nice pile... to broken into small pieces and spread over 20 miles. If we can get in there and get the stuff when nature's put it in a heap for us, we can get it out of the marine environment and really make an impact. I mean, the beach cleans we've done so far, we've done 40 beach cleans in the last year with about 16 tonnes of rubbish, but a lot of that's come in big lumps where we've cleaned over 4 tonnes in a morning. And, you know, it's a drop in the ocean, pardon the pun, but... if we can get the stuff, it's out of the marine environment.
My name's Lewis Matheson, crew member for RNLI Stonehaven.
What kind of role can RNLI play in getting some of this stuff off? Because, I mean, OK, they can bag it up. How do they actually get it off the beach?
As part of a training night, we're doing a coastal tour and sort of looking at local points. So we're improving our local knowledge of the area. And whilst we're doing that, we'll stop off and pick up the bags and bring them back.
So rather than pick up a 100-kilogram dummy, you're going to be picking up a 400-kilogram bag of rubbish.
Aye, that's about it.
That's going to be entertaining. That'll be good fun.
Aye, will be.
Marie Goujon is the MSP for Angus North and the Mearns, one of the beach cleaners here today. What have you been getting so far?
Well, I found some bigger bits, a big bit of foam there, part of a metal grill. It looks like some sort of plastic cap of something, little bits of rope, but... quite a lot of broken up bits of polystyrene, little bits of shredded plastic and things like that. Yeah. So, yeah, a bit of a mixture. You can tell that people have had little barbecues or fires around here, left glass bottles, we found quite a lot of glass smashed and things like that too. So,
you were here as the MSP, but
yes.
you also happen to be Minister for Rural Affairs and Natural Environment. How does an initiative like this fit in with Scottish Government policy?
Oh, it's absolutely key to what we are trying to do, because marine litter in particular is something that we all have a part to play in. So obviously I think it's important that as a government we look at all measures we can to first of all try and prevent litter from getting into our oceans and our seas in the first place, but also what we can do to try and help clean that up. So I mean, one of the initiatives we had, for example, was helping to fund innovation. Does anybody have any ideas about what we can be doing to try and extract the litter from the seas in the first place? But also supporting initiatives like, well, the beachlands that we're seeing here today, mapping the coast and trying to find all the litter hotspots that can be hard to access normally by land as well. So it's really important that we try and support all these initiatives that are going on too. But also, I mean, a big part of my job as an MSP is going around speaking to kids in schools. This is one of the biggest issues that they always raise with me, asking what we're doing about it, but also telling me about all the different the beach cleans that they're doing as well. It's about everybody playing their part, because it's if you're taking a walk along the beach, take a carrier bag with you and, you know, pick up a few bits as you go, because all of that does make a massive difference.
I'm Colin Moffat. I'm the Chief Scientific Advisor Marine to Scottish Government. What I'm doing is picking up litter, marine litter, bits of plastic, wee bits of glass, paper and polystyrene.
How much science is actually going into figuring out where this stuff is coming from, how it's distributed?
There's quite a lot of science actually going into this now. We've got recognised ways of sampling beaches, recognised ways of sampling our sea surface, and actually working out what is where.
How do you scan something like this? How do you get... Because, I mean, some of these beaches are very, very remote.
What actually we've been doing at Marine Scotland is we've had one of our modellers model beaches.
Can I take it this is virtual modelling?
This is virtual modelling, okay. Yes. Right. So they model how long the litter might get there, where the litter might come from, and we're getting quite a good handle now on where perhaps we should be going and where the litter is going to be coming from.
How do you stop it getting into the sea in the first place?
Well, unfortunately, a significant amount is coming from us. It's coming from what we're doing as individuals. And we just have to think about actually recycling as much as we can, reusing as much as we can, and disposing of as little as we can.
Yeah, we had an amazing beach clean up at Cairnbulg, which is one of our sort of nasty spots. It's just the way the tides work. Everything ends up in one small patch. Blue gloves after blue gloves after blue gloves. 557 in 1 kilometre of beach. Even worse was the oil filters. We had 49 complete oil filters from medium-sized vessels. You know, they weren't clean when they went into the sea. They were full of oil, as they are. And surely we shouldn't be losing stuff like that. I mean, you can drop a glove, but accidentally dropping an oil filter? No.
Ian Hay and his volunteers from Marine Scotland, Marie Gouchon, MSP, we heard from too, and Crawford Paris of Turning the Plastic Tide.
That's just amazing.
Well, all those gloves you could understand.
Well, no, you can't even understand that.
Well, you can, because if you're out at sea, a wind picks up the glove and blows it over the side.
Yeah, that's a lot of chance. Anyway, okay, I'll give you that point, but the oil filters?
Yeah, that sounds deliberate.
How hard is it to put it in a container and take it back?
Well, I wonder, actually, if that's the issue. Is there a cost associated with taking it back? Because, again, this is a minor example. I think we may have mentioned this before. The recycling plants in Aberdeenshire, in this part of Scotland, have stopped taking car tyres.
Yeah.
Now, what are people going to do with them?
Also,
I saw this happen in Glasgow, and all of a sudden, the lay-bys were full of tyres.
Yeah, I mean, they're good for planting tatties in. You stack four of them up, fill them full of compost, and they're great for that. But you're right. And I would imagine businesses, like fishing boats, will be charged to get rid of the refuse. And that's possibly why some of it ends up over the side.
Yeah, could be.
And that needs to change. I mean, it's short-termism, charging people for bringing car tyres, because, you know, what do you do with them?
Yes, aye. Anyway, Loch Katrin, going from saltwater to freshwater, Loch Katrin is the principal water supply for the city of Glasgow and other parts of central Scotland. So you wouldn't necessarily think, off the bat, that it would be somewhere that would, A, welcome people in to actually go floaty out in the water, you know, and B, would attract very many people, but you'd be wrong, because it's a serious tourist hotspot.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It is a great place to visit. And it's just one of those wee gems of suddenly you step back in time.
One of the ways you step back in time is going out on the Sir Walter Scott. Steamships have been very popular in the lochs since Victorian times, and they still are extremely popular, as Gordon Allen explains.
This is the steamship Sir Walter Scott on Loch Katrin, built in 1899 by William Denny Brothers of Dumbarton.
I've heard about this boat before. Bear in mind, there is no way of sailing a boat up here. How did they get it up here?
Interesting. So, built by Denny's, done its trials down the Clydes around the Isle of Arran, back to the shipyard, dismantled, taken to the southern end of Balloch.
The unriveted it, took it to bits.
Well, there you are. It's incredible, absolutely incredible. So, it done its trials on the Clydes around Arran, back to the shipyard, dismantled, southern end of Loch Lomond to Balloch, by barge all the way up to Inversnaid, and then by horse and cart, extremely large horses, taking it over to Stronaclacker, where it was reassembled and came into service in March 1900.
Bearing in mind that this is one of the major water supplies for Glasgow, what kind of engine has this thing got that is clean enough to actually go on drinking water?
I think that's the beauty of the vessel. She still has her original steam engine. It's a Matthew Paul triple expansion steam engine. The original engine that was on the vessel in 1899, been rebuilt three times now. So that is the whole thing, extracting the water from the loch, turning it into steam through the boilers, and then being discharged back through the condenser back into the loch. So a lovely cycle of water.
You're not still using coal?
No, challenge there, huge, huge challenge. She was up until 2005, 2006. We had huge challenges. We used to burn Welsh steam coal, which was really, really good. Terrific output from it. But unfortunately, demise of the coal industry in the UK. At one point, we were burning Polish steam coal, fantastic coal, until the Chinese found out about it, and they bought everything for their power stations. For a short time, we were burning Russian steam coal, but unfortunately, when the boilers flashed in the morning, well, the car park would disappear from vision. If a lady came on with a white blouse, she left with a grey blouse. And it got really, really difficult. And that was one of our challenges, to say, how could we retain the steamship, but what was an alternative fuel?
See, this is a bit like steam trains. I would imagine that Joe Public would have loved the fact that, I mean, somebody was physically shovelling coal into the beast.
Well, better than that, when it was on coal, do you know, we used to give a bit of coal to somebody at the booking office and say, jokingly aside, would you take that along to the engineer, he's short of coal? And they would actually do it. They would do it. And they'd all be part of that. But
carrying it carefully in two hands.
There you are. But to smell the coal in the morning, to smell that funnel and the steam coming out, it took people back to their childhood, to be honest with you. Yeah. That's been lost. That's been lost. So that's one of the downsides.
How did you get the coal up here?
Well, it used to come in extremely large lorries, rigid lorries initially. But then because of costs and haulage charges, then came an Arctic transportation. You would have about 30 tonnes of coal dumped in the car park. That would manually be shoveled into barrows, motorised barrows, because of health and safety. It would be taken along the veranda to the boat, dumped into the coal bunkers. Cycle starts again, shoveled from the coal bunkers into the boilers, raked, ash, then shoveled out of the boilers and done a repeat journey back into the car park. And then disposed of. So it was quite a labour intensive. A lot of, really labour intensive.
Yeah, a lot of handling. So if it's not coal nowadays, what is it?
Oil fired.
Okay.
And we, depending on the ambient temperature, we can burn on pure rapeseed. Or I should say, it's a biofuel. But what we've got to be careful of is the viscosity. As the temperature starts to drop, the viscosity of the oil gets a lot, lot thicker. If you had the motorhome of the caravan and you forget to leave your oil in the cupboard, you go to it and it's gone white, it's thick, like old cooking fat. Yeah. So, and at that stage...
That's giving you roots away, boy.
Well, really, sorry about that.
Cooking.
Oops. but yeah, and then it becomes a little bit more acidic. And that's when the challenges can happen, because it can attack the diaphragm, seals, etc., etc.
Okay, right, fair enough. How popular is this as a tourist attraction?
Very popular, absolutely. I mean, luckily enough, over the years, it's grown year on year. Sir Walter Scott's poem, 1810. It was the nucleus. Some people even say the birthplace of tourism in Scotland. About 300,000 visitors a year now. So it's quite significant for central Scotland and the Trossachs.
And how many people can you actually put on this boat legally?
Well, when she was built in 1899, she was licensed to carry 540.
Never!
540.
They must have been smaller in those days.
And don't go all to the one side at
no,
one
exactly.
time. I've known the vessel carrying 416. And then for various changes, and all for the right reasons, we now carry 245.
Yeah. Yeah, and who actually owns and runs all this?
This is owned by the Steamship Sir Walter Scott Trust. And it's operated by Steamship Sir Walter Scott Limited. Mm-hmm. The trust, if it wasn't for a gentleman, Sir William McAlpine, he was the man that really came to the rescue of Sir Walter Scott. A huge steam enthusiast, mainly trains, to be honest with you, the Flying Scotsman. Mm-hmm. He was lucky enough to own it twice in his lifetime.
Wow.
But he was very much instrumental. So Sir William and the five trustees put a package together and they took the operation over in 2004, 2005.
Yeah. It's strange because I always forget, I've been here several times, you forget how close to central Scotland all this is. You know, one minute you are
basically driving through a major arterial tourist route,
and then
you kind of sort of hang a left, and it gets quieter and quieter and quieter, and then it becomes more and more wooded, and eventually you kind of, almost as if you were coming out of a green tunnel,
yep,
and you're confronted by the entrance to the loch here and the boat, and it's... Magical. It has a natural romance to it.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the whole thing. I mean, you have the conical shape on the right-hand side of Ben Ann, twin peaks of Ben Venue. Within 2 or 3 minutes, we're at Ellen's Isle, and then it's the open loch. You sail up Loch Katrine. You're not that far from Loch Lomond. You see Ben Lomond. You see Strona Clacker. And then you've got Glengyle, the home of the McGregors. So, do you know, it's a magical... When I came here many, many years ago, my boss at the time said, Gordon, if you last a month, you might stay three. If you last three and you get through the summer, it'll become a part of your life. And I thought, don't be so silly. That was 35 years ago. Never left. What can I say?
The hugely enthusiastic Gordon Allen of the Sir Walter Scott Steamship, and we'll have more from Loch Katrine coming up shortly.
If you're a visitor to Scotland, go and do that. It is just tremendous. As I said earlier on, you take a step back in time. It's a magical place. It's a bit like Narnia. Mm. You leave the hustle and bustle of the Central Belt and you're back in the land of Rob Roy MacGregor. It's fantastic.
Quite. Well, just this business is going to be, you're actually in quite, somewhere like Callander, you're quite, that's a really big tourist town. And then just outside that, you take a turn to the left and follow this wee road along for a few miles. And then all of a sudden, it's almost as if you enter a ravine or a gully or a gorge or something.
Yeah, it's like this.
And it's just different.
Yeah, it's a great place for an ambush. You go through these go through these big cliffs on either side.
Aye.
And then it opens out, not hugely at the start.
Yeah.
And the main thing is you've got the steam launch,
yes,
the Walter Scott. And you get on that and it goes out into the loch. And it's a great thing. You get to put your bikes on it, you have to book it, and sail up to the far end and then cycle back. It's great.
Obviously, not just a pedal-powered bike. It would have to be a battery-powered bike.
Well, it's flat all the way, so...
Yeah. Not downhill, then.
No. As we'll find out later in the programme.
Earlier, we heard from ecologist David Hetherington about species like bear and elk, which were once common in Scotland, but are now extinct, obviously. The herd of reindeer near Aviemore are a familiar sight nowadays, but what about their ancestors?
Those reindeer have been in the Cairngorm since 1952, when a Swedish Sami reindeer herdsman called Mikkel Utsi had the slightly crazy idea of bringing reindeer to the UK. And he looked around, particularly in Scotland, and the Cairngorm struck him as an area that reminded him most of his homeland back in Sweden. And interestingly, it was for the same reason that the Norwegian commandos, the Company Linge, pitched up in the Cairngorms in the 1940s, and there's still a Norwegian flag fluttering around in Glenmore as we speak. So there is this similarity, and that is why reindeer are here. But they're semi-domestic reindeer, so they're physiologically and behaviourally quite different from the wild reindeer from which they're descended. So we don't have any wild reindeer in this country, although wild reindeer still exist in parts of Scandinavia.
So were wild reindeer part of the Scottish ecosystem?
They certainly were. Their bones, particularly their antlers and fragments of antlers, have been found across Scotland, particularly, it has to be said, in the Central Belt. But also, there's been a huge number of antler fragments found around the bone caves near Inchnadamph in northwest Sutherland, which suggest, actually from the shape of those antlers, that the area around those caves was a traditional calving site. So the antlers seem to be largely from female reindeer. Reindeer are unusual, that the females have got antlers. And there's a small number of young male antlers, suggesting that perhaps there were some young male reindeer there with their mothers. So a traditional calving ground up in the northwest Highlands for what seems to be thousands of years. Now, there's quite a bit of debate about exactly when the wild reindeer went extinct in Scotland and why it went extinct in Scotland. Now, as everybody knows, reindeer are a very northern species. They're very adapted to a cold environment. They can, you know, survive minus 50, no problem, because they've got a fantastic coat. And they've got all sorts of adaptations to a cold, icy environment. And the most recent carbon date we've got for them suggests that they may well have gone extinct just shortly after the end of the Ice Age, you know, when tundra conditions begin to disappear and woodland begins to colonise Scotland. However, there's a couple of pieces of tantalising cultural evidence that suggest that they may have hung on in two of the landscapes that you might, you know, perhaps suspect there might have been later survival. So the very north of the mainland, around Caithness Sutherland, and here in the Cairngorms, which is actually the biggest area of Arctic alpine environment we've got in the UK today. And so firstly, we have a Pictish stone that was found just within walking distance of here, Ewan, actually just outside Granton and Spey. And that's probably from about the 7th century. Now, most people would look at that and say, that's a red deer. In fact, you know, it's very often described as showing a red deer stag. Some people, however, have looked at that and said, hold on, that's not a red deer stag, that's a reindeer. Now, and I showed a photograph of that stone, which is now actually in the National Museum in Edinburgh. I showed that to a colleague in Finland who manages a wild reindeer conservation project, and his immediate reaction was, reindeer.
So the Picts must have seen them.
So they may well have done it. Like I say, there's a bit of interpretation required. It's not a camera trap photograph. It's an artist's depiction of a deer, and so it is open to interpretation, but there is at least some suggestion that it could be a reindeer rather than a red deer, in which case that would suggest that in Pictish times there were still reindeer in the Cairngorms. And what we also have, more recently again, from the northern mainland, is a reference in a Norse saga, the Orkney Inga saga, that was written in the early 13th century. And it talks about how the Jarls, or Earls of Orkney, would go across to Caithness to hunt, quote, red deer and reindeer. Now, that sounds like a pretty good bit of evidence that there were still reindeer living in the North Mainland in medieval times. Some academics have argued, however, that that is artistic license and shouldn't be taken literally, that was basically a phrase that would have been used by, you know, bards in Norway, and that would have been taken over and just, you know, employed as a kind of a device, an artistic device. I suppose it could also be argued that there may well have been reindeer in Caithness at that time, but they weren't necessarily native Scottish ones. They could have been brought over from Norway specifically for the purposes of hunting. But it casts some doubt on whether they may well have died out at the end of the Ice Age. But it has to be said, there's an awful long gap between the radiocarbon dating evidence from 10,000 years ago or so and this kind of slightly dubious, open to interpretation medieval evidence.
Our favourite kind of evidence, slightly yes, dubious, kind of open to
vague
interpretation.
Shades of grey type of evidence.
Yeah, it might be, might not be, you never know.
It's more of a legend.
Yeah, more of a myth. More guidelines than rules, really. Anyway, that was Dr. David Hetherington. You're listening to the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElrath.
Yeah, we've got loads coming up, including a rather heavy going cycle route from Dufton to Keith.
Other people may differ. We got contacted by Colleen Carney, who said, just wanted to let you know, I love listening to the show. I live in Australia, but 5 hours west of Sydney. Do a lot of driving, as I work 5 hours further west of home. That's confusing. So each week or two, I head home for a few days and download your shows to make the trip more enjoyable.
Yeah, we're facing a severe drought here, and the whole areas are running out of drinking water, let alone water for anything else. And listening to you allows me to escape the red dust here and take me back to the green, fresh, beautiful places that you visit.
She's saying they've got 45 to 50 degree days there at the moment. That's just
well, it's 50 mile an hour winds, drizzle, and 11 degrees here.
So what you might describe as balmy in Scotland, truth to be told. There is a slightly watery theme to this podcast. We're going to turn our attention now to the Angus Coastal Festival. It's the second year of the festival, which runs across 11 days. Now, bear in mind, what we're talking about here, you can go and visit more or less any time, or most of it. One thing in this you can't, but that's too bad. Kellyanne Dempsey is one of the organisers of the Coastal Festival.
We are at Ferry Den today on Lighthouse Road, and we're looking at the mouth of the River South Esk as that joins the North Sea. So you can see a nice sandbank ahead where you'd be seeing seals, possibly, eider ducks in the river, and on a nice clear day you would be able to see 6-7 miles to the north to St Cyrus Beach as well. So we have a lovely big golden sandy bay here.
I'm just laughing at the nice clear day reference because it's not today. It's kind of shmurry and grey and claggy generally. It's a big grey heron just landing in the waterside there. We're not terribly far away from Montrose. You can see the spire across there. There's a big industrial estate just across the other side of the river. I'm ashamed to say, I've never been this side of the river.
It's a beautiful spot here. You can walk out to the lighthouse. It's about a half-hour walk from Ferry Den, but you can also walk around the headlands here at Montrose and right along to the harbour and cross the river between Montrose and Ferry Den and walk over Rossy Island as well, which was once an island in the middle of the River Channel.
Who are you aiming this festival at?
We sort of aimed it at locals and visitors within maybe a couple of hours' drive. We're working with a lot of school groups, local families, people with an interest in protecting and enhancing the coastline as well. So we tie the festival into the Marine Conservation Society's Beach Clean Weekend, And we're also looking at marine litter through the Littoral Art Project this year as well. Then we have events through the 11-day period aimed at special interest. We have a whale and dolphin walk here where we'll do a Sea-Watch Foundation walk as well. And that's with St Andrews University Marine Mammal Unit. We work with Butterfly Conservation, Angus and Dundee Bird Club. So, focus on wildlife and the habitats.
Ah, good.
Yes.
There's birds across there that I can't recognise. See them? I think they might be... When I say they can't recognise them, they were just in amongst the tussocks, wheat ears. There's big flocks there of chaffinches. We're walking along a tarmac path, so there's black knapweed, still the purple stuff beside us. The thistle has gone off into seed. And consequently, occasionally you get a real flash of colour as the goldfinches go past. That's a lot of wildlife in this area.
There is. It's a good site for corn bunting and things as well. It could be a corn bunting. Ah. You're seeing some of the farms participating in management on the site too. But it's a really good site for seabirds, gannets, there's a cormorant down there, different gulls, the eider ducks. And marine mammals, it's a great spot for bottlenose dolphins, which can be seen quite frequently fishing in the River Channel right up to the harbour to the west. We've also had a humpback whale 2 summers ago for six weeks. Yeah.
6 weeks.
Six weeks it stayed in the summer. Normally they might be passing through in winter, but it did hang around for 6 weeks. Quite a lot at the north end at St Cyrus as well, but that was quite a sight. So it's one of the best spots in Angus because we're raised up as well. The headlands are all really good for scanning the sea for whales and dolphins.
One of the things I really like about this area, even just driving at the ferry down there just now, it's an old fishing village. It still has that feel to it. It's still got the tarry sheds. It's still got the, you know, the poles for drying your nets, that kind of thing. It's a lot of history.
Yes, there is, particularly salmon fishing.
Aye.
Yeah.
Well, Lewisons are just down the road there.
Yeah, and you can still see the remnants of the stake nets. Aye. On the beach. You can still see them today, actually, aye, sticking out there as well.
Just across the other side there.
Yeah, so for hundreds of years, people have fished. There's an old salmon fishing bothy in the reserve as well. Montrose Basin's a really unusual enclosed estuary. There aren't really many, so it's a really special site. So we have a lot of events taking place in the estuary itself. We have a kids' mud activity where we go out and look at all the creatures that live in the mud there, and also the ponds and habitats around the Scottish Wildlife Trust site.
Of all the lineup this year, what's the one bit that you're most looking forward to?
The lighthouse that we're walking out to just now is a Stevenson Lighthouse, a Skurdiness Lighthouse that was opened in 1870. Uh-huh. I had read that there had been about 11 shipwrecks in the mouth of the river here, so the local fishermen in Ferryden petitioned them in 1867 to have a lighthouse built here. So it was built, but interestingly I read that it was painted black during World War II, so it couldn't be used as a daytime marker. Yes, so it's obviously automated now, but I'm from Montrose and I've never seen inside it. So it was nice to work with the Northern Lighthouse Board, who've been really generous in opening it for the day.
Now, be honest, you set up that entire thing just so you could get inside the lighthouse?
Pretty much. Yeah.
What's this thing here? That's a very odd, probably about 8-9 feet tall. It's not a cairn.
It's
almost like a pillar or something.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
There are one or two on the other side of the...
There's another one there.
Yeah, other shore.
Well, it's actually for ships lining up or something, so you know the way in.
Yeah.
Ancient monument. There we go, it says. Navigation aids. The beacons. Ships approaching the river mouth were steered to keep the towers in a line in a course that avoided the dangers on either side. Okay. Right.
Yeah, quite a treacherous. There's a sandbank there called Granite Bank. It's quite a large sandbank.
Well, you can see there and there. It obviously gets shallower there just with the way the waves are breaking.
Mm-hmm. So you can see all the rocky shore there as well. It's really good for rock pooling. And when we have some beach cleans in the second weekend, we do a sandy shore at Ferryden and then we do the rocky shore behind the lighthouse at Oozen as well.
Kellyanne Dempsey talking about the Angus Coastal Festival, but bear in mind a lot of those things you can go and see any time of the year. Just go and enjoy it, because it is an area of Scotland, I would say that section of coastline, that's not well
It's a bit like kind of Berwick and Duns. It's a wee bit off the beaten track.
Yeah.
And it is a beautiful coastline and arguably some of the best beaches in Scotland.
Yes, yeah. I would agree entirely. Last week, Ewan took what you might describe as an experimental journey in sound on a heritage railway which started off in Keith.
Morning. A beautiful day.
It's just wonderful.
So where are we going today?
Dufftown, yeah.
So how long is that going to take?
Oh, it takes about 38 minutes.
Cracking day for it.
It's really nice.
Go and tell me about this engine. What is it?
It's a diesel multiple unit, class 108.
Still got his British Railways sign on the side?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Am I correct that this closed in 1991?
We are closed, yes. It was still open a wee while for was Northern Bell.
Northern Bell.
They come up.
I can remember as a very young BBC reporter covering one of the last scheduled services from here.
Oh, aye.
And it was jam packed full of men of a certain age.
So the first leg of your journey was by train?
Yeah, it was the Keith, the Whiskey Heritage Line, which runs from Keith up to Dufftown and back. Delightful old rickety rail bus. With a big smiley whiskers there. And if anybody of a certain age can remember, they were all over Scotland. And green with these big white highlights just in the front, and it looks like a big smile.
See, you've just basically highlighted what your mental problem was.
Which?
You've just said the train that runs from Keith up to Dufftown.
Yeah.
Which would imply
that Dufftown back to Keith is downhill. No. So wrong. Basically, the train gets up to Keith. I got the bike out of the guard's van. They were delightful. I said, you know, can I put the bike in the guard's?
Oh,
of course you can.
Aye.
So long as there's space. If you are going to do that, there's no facilities.
Yeah.
It's a guard's van.
Yes.
Take some elastic or a rope or something to tie it up.
Or an elastoplast.
Anyway, yeah, more than that later. Anyway, I said, I got the bike out of the van and took to what I thought would be an easy cycle downhill. Well, that's us. Off the train, the hustle and bustle of Dufftown behind me. Still very much an old railway line, but well off the road. Great track so far. Lots of seeds of willow herb flying everywhere. I might have to get my sunglasses on. But it's well signposted so far. And we're now gliding down a hill. Oops. It's a lovely wee bridge over the river. A little suspension bridge. Now, do I cycle it? I don't think so. It's just the width of the handlebars plus 3 inches. It's about 60 feet long. It's over the River Isla in the middle of nowhere. You've got a real burnt umber texture to the water. Some of the stones covered in weed, really bright green. There's reds, there's oranges, there's pinks, there's a butterfly. There's a whole pile of contrast so far. This is a bit of a shock to the system. I'd kind of naively thought, because the train journey was mainly up, that this leg of it would be mainly down. But there is a brutal hill on the Isle of Wight coming out of Dufftown. The sun is splitting the sky. It's about 25, 26 degrees. And as you can tell, I'm seriously pecking. The more discerning of you will notice the slight electric hum. It is an electric bike. I've only got a set of one at the moment. I do have the option of going up to six. I'm trying to battle through it at the moment, but six may well become a reality by the end of the journey. You've always got the worry about range anxiety. You don't want to hit a monster hill as you hit zero on the battery. But it's, oh goodness me. I was just looking at it, stretching way out in front of me. Should I be moaning? Absolutely not. It is wonderful. The rolling hills of Ballysteil not been cut up here. This is on a wee B-class road at the moment. Not a soul on it. This is original. Somebody's got a letterbox at the end of the farm road. And it's an old microwave. Wonderful. I'm about 5 miles out now, and as I said earlier on, the first 3 miles is brutal, it's all uphill. And then you're onto a delightful downhill track. It's pretty rough, I wouldn't take it on a road bike or even a hybrid bike. And I'm standing beside some really run-down, dilapidated buildings of a croft house. That lovely red of the rusted corrugated iron. But you think it's probably well over 100 years old. It's still pretty much intact. The wood's gone, but the metal's still here. I've got a wind farm off to my left, waving heads of barley in the sunshine. And coming down that track, stony track, but grass in the middle. And there's buttercups, there's pinks, there's oranges, there's reds, and every hue of green. It's terrific. And the thistle in front of me, there's a wee breeze got up, and the thistle is shedding its seeds there, and there is an absolute snowstorm of thistle seeds heading out towards Murray at the moment. But the reason I stopped here is I had to get the first aid kit out. And this is a new one for me, bordering on the stupidity, because if you've got an electric bike, you know the battery clips on, and then you have a key to lock it in place. I forgot the key. So I've been trying to ride down that stony track, holding the battery into the bike with my knee and cursing at my stupidity. But I've had a bit of a brainwave. I've got the first aid kit out, for which I'm eternally grateful for remembering to bring. And I've got a big sticking plaster over the whole thing, so it's holding the battery in place. Probably never used the sticking plaster for this before. I've never used the first aid kit on a trip before. But I'm glad I brought it. We're just coming up to Dromure Station, about a quarter of a mile away, and through the trees I can just see the whiskers of the train as it leaves the station. It's nice to know it's there, for some strange reason. Two and a half miles to go to Keith Town Square. I'm just watching the train back on the original journey from Keith to Dufton. It seems odd seeing it from this different perspective, as it just narrowly weaves its way ever so slowly and delicately through the Aberdeenshire countryside. It disappears every now and again, the cutting reappears, just steady, slow, rhythmic. And that's it. I'm just coming into where I started 3.5 hours ago. The Keith and Duff Down Railway Whiskey Line and the Isle of Wight. It's been a great trip. Delightful train journey. Hard on the cycle now and again, a bit challenging. But for me, the overriding memory is coming down that escarpment and going over the viaduct with a wheel screaming and the brakes binding.
So that sounds like a great trip. Tiring, but great.
Yeah, I think, if I'm being honest, I think it was more of a walk in places, because some of it is a real slog. But it was great, beautiful. And but those sounds, if you get the chance, go back to the Sounds app, BBC Sounds app, and look up last week's programme, and just the delightful sound of an ageing train.
Yeah.
Either that or it was my knees.
Could have been one of the two. One of the two. Let's go back to Loch Katrine and that steamship, the Sir Walter Scott. My guide, Gordon Allen, who's a general manager, said, do you want to see down in amongst the engines?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Oh, this is fab. Basically, I'm just backing my way down into the engine room to have a word with Scott, the engineer.
This is a triple expansion steam engine from 1899.
It is beautifully, beautifully put together. There's a crankshaft going on here. Everything's going up and down. Brass work on the top, beautifully painted red and blue and things. It's immaculate. You know, all the copper's been shone. It's an absolute delight.
We spend a lot of time every morning making sure it's all polished and nice and clean for the punters to come on and for them to enjoy it at its best.
I am guessing that this is a bit like a steam train. I mean, and that they've all got characters. What's the character of this one?
She's very unique. We call her the Grand Old Lady because she just keeps going. So we're very fond of her.
Presumably, you can't get spares for something like this. If something breaks, you have to make it.
It's very difficult to get spares. If something does break, we have to spec it ourselves. And if we can't make it ourselves, then we farm it out and we get it made. But we ourselves install it. So
this is proper engineering?
Oh, yes. Engineering at its best.
Let's take a wee visit to the bridge.
Yeah, in you go.
All right, thank you.
More than welcome.
It's considerably quieter up here, I like this.
Yeah, it's a lot quieter.
Yeah. I'm Neil Michael, I'm doing the driving.
You're doing the driving. There might be an assumption that because we're in a loch and surrounded by hills, that this would be a skoosh, it'd be an easy job, is it?
Not as easy as I'd hope it would have been. It's a bit breezy, it must be said. The wind howls down the loch when it's blowing, so it's... It adds an interesting dimension to it.
Yeah, you've got quite a lot of boat above the water here.
Yes, it gets a bit windblown, especially if you're going in, say, to Stornoch Lock and you get blown in sideways. It makes it a bit interesting.
Yeah. I have been on umpteen steam trains over the years, and you could just about see the sense of that in that, the engine drivers... possibly used to work for British Rail in the past, might have been engineers, shunting trains about and things. So they got a background experience. How about you?
I used to be at sea, I have a bit of background experience, so which is helpful here for driving a boat round, but there's no radars or any fancy equipment here. This is somewhat more basic than I was used to.
It's the Mark One eyeball, basically.
Steam eyeball.
Even more old-fashioned. What do you see in the way of wildlife here?
There's some ospreys actually fly around. We've got two pairs of ospreys nesting, one at this end and one at the other end of the loch, one up near the Black Isle and one near Ellen's Isle there. There's also apparently a couple of golden eagles there occasionally seen, and there are other birds of prey kicking around. Earlier this year there were a lot of wild goats around, but I've not seen them recently, and there's 1,000 head or so of deer on the hills up there. Yeah. But there are a lot of wild goats. They came over from the side of Loch Lomond, where they came from.
It's a right mixture of a day, though, because I mean, we've had brilliant sunshine and now it's going grey and overcast and a bit shmurry.
Suddenly the wind's picked up. Yeah, it was lovely and sunny earlier this morning. In fact, an hour ago it was lovely and sunny, but now it's a bit overcast and miserable. But that's Scotland for you. In another half hour it'll be bright and sunny again.
You have a compass binnacle here.
Yep.
You've got, what is that?
A barometer.
Barometer, yes.
Give an idea of what's going to happen. Rudder indicator.
Rudder indicator, a wheel.
Telegraph.
And a telegraph.
We don't need a lot in the way of navigation aids here because there's only us here and we don't sail if we can't see.
Tell me who you are and where you're from.
I'm Malcolm Howe and I'm from Malta, but originally UK.
What do you think of the trip?
Oh, the trip's good. It's natural. It's in a lovely environment and a little 1 hour trip on a really nice day. Yes, very nice. Could do with a fishing rod behind the boat though.
My name's Atif. I thought it was actually quite fantastic. Really nice scenery and a lot of learning to be done on the wee trip that we had.
Yeah.
So I was really impressed. It's the first time I've been up this way.
there's a real sense of actually being able to see the hills properly.
That's true. I mean, we went round. I didn't even realise we actually turned round on the boat.
Neither did
I. On the way back, and we're like, I'm sure I've seen this side, but no, it was nice. And again, it's not that crowded, so we went upstairs, downstairs. It was really good. My kids enjoyed it as well.
I don't know how many people there are on board this boat at the moment. You're probably talking certainly over 150, maybe as many as 200 people. And they're sitting on benches underneath the awning, sheltering from the rain, or they're downstairs in the cafe, or they're upstairs. There's a wee tea bar up there too, and they're even on the bow of the boat. So you would expect it to be fairly, I don't know, crowded, packed, separate from the experience of nature. But you're absolutely surrounded by these hills.
Bearing in mind how close you are to Loch Lomond and Glasgow and Callander and Craneark and everything else, it is actually surprisingly remote here.
Absolutely. Take you right back to Sir Walter Scott's poem. What was it that inspired him with his poetry, his novels? It's the beauty, the isolation. It's majestic. I can't put it any other way. Absolutely majestic.
Gordon Allen, hugely enthusiastic, and his crew on the Sir Walter Scott.
It is just a great thing, you know, just a delightful boat. Yeah. And the fact that they keep it going is fantastic, yes, as well.
Yeah. It's great. And they keep it in such good nick as well. Yeah. It's just a wee gem.
Yeah, loads to do in Scotland. You give that one, add that to your list.
Sadly, that's all we've got time for this particular podcast. Thanks very much for downloading us. Next week, I've got something completely different. We've been talking recently about Scottish sporting estates. Now, a few years ago, I did a couple of programmes based in South Africa on a game reserve there, and I put two and two together, and I thought, there are actually comparisons here between what happens in Scotland and what's happening. There's all sorts of very interesting differences. It was a bit like being in an episode of Daktari, if you're old enough to remember that. You know, we were darting lions and cheetah and chasing down zebras and helicopters and pickup trucks and everything else. It was really exciting. But, as I said, it is the comparisons I find really illuminating.
Yeah, have a listen to that, and if you've got any comments on it, you can comment on anything, yeah, at outofdoors, all one word, at bbc.co.uk.
From all the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.